Welcome to the Infectious Myth. I'm David Crow. Today I want to talk about Ebola. I feel very alone on this issue, which has been adopted with fear and trepidation by America, particularly by America. Whether you're a fan of Obama, who hugged a supposed Ebola victim, if you believe that at night he sneaks into hospitals to give comfort to Ebola victims, if you still believe he's an agent of change, or whether you are one of those people who sincerely thought he wasn't a natural-born American, or one of those people who just adopted that view because you don't think black men should be bosses, or whether you like to theorize that all new pathogens have been created by the U.S. or other governments and that Ebola is designed in military labs to bring us closer to the new world order, or if you think Africa is a dirty, hopeless place that doesn't deserve our sympathy, or whether you're a liberal, progressive, or socialist who thinks that neocolonialism has created the conditions in which a virus like Ebola can flourish, poverty and malnutrition. Whether you think everyone from West Africa should be quarantined for 21 days or just people who've been helping with the epidemic, whether you think people should be quarantined in a prison or a hospital or at home, or whether you think quarantine should be reserved for those with symptoms, you're wrong. You're all wrong. It's possible for opposite opinions to be wrong. If you're falsely accused of murder, the prosecution might ask you, did you deliberately kill him, or was it an accident? Leaving in the assumption that you did the killing, and leaving out the possibility that you didn't. The same with Ebola. You all assume there is a pathogen, and as you will hear in this episode, that's an unwarranted, unproven assumption. But first, I do want to hear from you. Email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And I want to hear from you so badly that I have a deal for you. I'm an amateur photographer, and my handmade bookmarks adorned with one of my photos are admired by everyone who sees them. Everyone wants one, and most people want more than one. And you can get one for free simply by writing to me. Obviously, you'll need to send me your mailing address. And that's not all. If you tell me that you've liked facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth on Facebook, and you're not fibbing, you get another. And if you follow the show on Twitter, follow Infectious Myth on Twitter, you get another. And if you've left a review on iTunes, another. And if you say something about the show in your message to me that's worth repeating on air, you get another. So if you're my ultimate fan, you can get 5 different photographic bookmarks, all for free. If you're a hardcore vegan, you should know that my bookmarks have genuine silk ribbons, but I can send them without ribbons on special request. So, enough shameless self-promotion. Now for Ebola. Where do I start? Flaws in the diagnosis, in the testing, in the original papers, the irrational fear. Let's start by talking about the history of the disease, which is not all that old. It started with 3 papers in the same edition of The Lancet in 1977. The first of the 3 papers, in the order in which they were printed, was a paper by the Centers for Disease Control called Isolation and Partial Characterization of a New Virus Causing Acute Hemorrhagic Fever in Zaire. It's this paper in which the name Ebola, which is named after a river in Africa, originated. Remarkably, the Centers for Disease Control had one sample, that is, a blood serum from one person and also liver samples from that same person. They put the sample under the electron microscope. They found thread-like particles, which are what have been claimed in the past to be Marburg virus particles. They claimed they were identical to Marburg virus particles, but the antibodies and antigens were different. The antigens are proteins that were found in the sample, and the antibodies are reactions to those proteins. They also found serious liver damage, and on this basis, they claimed that they'd isolated the virus and that they'd proven that it was the cause of the illness that this unfortunate deceased man had had. The problem was with this is that the word isola, for anybody who knows Latin or Italian, isola is an island, and it means that something is separated from everything else. But a blood sample in no way separates the virus from everything else. They made no attempts at a purification of the virus. they just found that when they put these samples into a cell culture, they could find changes in the cell culture, cells dying, and they claimed that this was proof that a virus was present. But certainly there's lots of other things. Cellular materials could also have caused this. Or if this man was poisoned with something, that also could have caused his cell death. The virus particles weren't all that uniform. They said they were all approximately 100 nanometers in diameter, but the length varied from 300 to more than 1,500 nanometers. But just seeing particles under an electron microscope, first of all, doesn't prove that they're viral. And secondly, it doesn't tell you what kind of virus it is. And thirdly, it doesn't tell you that it's the cause of the disease, even if it is a virus. The second paper was from the British laboratory, Porton Down. And that noted that the outbreak of the epidemic, which I should have mentioned, occurred in Sudan and Zaire in late 1976, that the outbreak occurred first in agricultural settlements. You would think that anything that occurred in agricultural settlements would bring up the possibility that people had been exposed to toxic pesticides, because in third world countries, pesticides are used with even less care than they are in first world countries, particularly in the 1970s. But there's no mention of any environmental examinations being done in this case. They injected this sample. They injected impure materials into guinea pigs, and they were able to find that after a few days, the guinea pigs got a fever. And one of the guinea pigs died, which doesn't exactly sound like a deadly virus, but of course this would be interpreted as a virus that cannot really infect guinea pigs. However, they found antibodies in the guinea pigs, which they claimed were antibodies to the Ebola virus. Again, they did not purify the virus, and there's really no evidence that the virus was causative, even though they called it the etiological agent, and etiology means causation. So they were claiming that this was the cause of the disease, but they really had no proof except that they could put foreign blood into a guinea pig and give it a fever and claim that that was due to the Ebola virus and not just to the exposure of a guinea pig to foreign blood. If we willy-nilly injected foreign blood into a human being without carefully checking their blood type, we could probably produce fevers and a lot worse reactions to the foreign blood. The third paper is important because one of the authors on the third paper was Peter Piot, who was at the World Health Organization and UNAIDS for a long time. Peter Piot has stated that he helped discover the Ebola virus, and his name on this paper indicates that he was in on the very beginning of the Ebola virus. He's now one of the top public health officials in the world and has a lot of influence, even if he doesn't have direct control over things. This study, which was done at the Institute of Tropical Medicine in Antwerp, was also based on a single patient, a woman in this case from Zaire, who did get a hemorrhagic syndrome. And they injected their sample under the skin and directly into the brain of mice. And they were able to kill a mouse. They hadn't been able to kill guinea pigs in the previous study, but in this study they were able to kill the mouse, and when they did cell culture in the test tube, they were able to find that the cells all died after some period of time. Again, there was no purification of the virus, and there's no real evidence that the virus was causative, because you can't study a mouse and claim that what you injected into the mouse, which is impure material, is a specific virus and that it is pathogenic to human beings. Also important to the history is the description of some of the earlier epidemics. There was a series of epidemics in Gabon between 1994 and 1997. One of the interesting things about this is that some of the people in this epidemic were diagnosed with yellow fever, who tested positive on yellow fever tests. Some tested positive on Ebola, and some didn't test positive on either, which means that you either have three different viruses or more than three viruses causing pretty much the same symptoms, or it's not viral at all. Again, there's no evidence that anybody looked into the environmental conditions. There is a sideways mention that the first people who came down with Ebola in Gabon in the mid-1990s were gold panners, illegal gold miners. The gold mining area has suffered substantial environmental destruction. The rock from which the gold is extracted it could have toxic metals in it that are associated with the gold. The process of extracting gold can use toxic chemicals. So there is a real possibility that there was some environmental condition which would cause some people to come down with a hemorrhagic fever. And hemorrhagic fever means a high fever with bleeding. And I'll get more into exactly what some of those symptoms are. So the interesting thing in this paper was not only did they find environmental contamination, which they didn't look into, but they found that 15 to 30% of people in the area had antibodies to Ebola, which suggested immunity to the disease. And so they claimed, they noted that this means one of two different things. Either Ebola is not really a very serious disease, and it's only in a small percentage of people who get the virus who actually get sick, or the Ebola tests are not very useful. And in order to prove that a test does not have a high rate of false positives, then it obviously needs to be tested a widespread survey of people who are outside any zone which is believed to have Ebola, people who are healthy or have other diseases that are clearly not Ebola symptoms. If you do this and you find that even 1% of people with the will test positive, you have a test that's really not going to be very useful, because 1%, if you test 10 million people, would be 100,000 people who would test positive on this test. And if in that area of 10 million people you have a small number of cases of Ebola, say 5 or 10, there's no way you're going to be able to distinguish the actual cases of Ebola with a test from people who just happen to have antibodies to it. In the most recent epidemic, which was in Zaire, started in the Congo, the health minister stated that 2 of 8 samples from victims of a mystery fever had tested positive for Ebola. So this is the same problem again. You're having identical symptoms, and a small percentage of people test positive for Ebola, but everybody seems to have the same symptoms, which would seem to indicate that Ebola is not the cause, because if Ebola was the cause, all 8 should have tested positive. But what if you took a random group of 8 people in the Congo and 2 out of 8 tested positive, as we've seen, that's not far off the percentage who tested positive in Gabon who did not have Ebola but came from villages in the area. You may very well find that 2 out of 8 people would test positive, 2 out of 8 healthy people might test positive. What that means is if you take 2 out of 8 people with a fever, they'll test positive for Ebola. It means nothing about whether Ebola is the cause of their fever or whether they would then progress to hemorrhagic fever if left untreated. It's very important for us to look at the definition of Ebola. And one of the definitions that is well documented is the European definition produced by the European Centers for Disease Control. And what it basically has is 4 criteria for in order to be classified as a proven or case of a confirmed case, they call it a confirmed case of Ebola. The first condition is a fever of 38.6 Celsius or above. And, you know, most people don't know how to put that into context. Finding the normal range of body temperatures is actually something that's very different. Everybody in the Fahrenheit zone knows that the normal body temperature is 98.6 Fahrenheit. What they don't know is that that derived in the 1800s from somebody who measured 37 Celsius, plus or minus half a degree Celsius. They didn't give a decimal point. It was converted to Fahrenheit, 98.6, but that does not mean 98.6 plus or minus a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit. It basically means 98.6 plus or minus 1 degree. So 38.6 degrees Celsius is, in fact, based on more recent measures of the normal range of human body temperatures, which are not precise to within a tenth of a degree, that this is a fever less than 1 degree above the normal range of body temperatures. So it's a fever, but it's not a very high fever. So that's criterion number one. The second criteria is any one of the following: a severe headache, vomiting, diarrhea, and abdominal pain, those three symptoms together, or hemorrhagic manifestations, or multi-organ failure, or somebody who died suddenly and inexplicably. So that basically means that somebody with a severe headache and a fever, which could be the normal flu, or somebody with vomiting and diarrhea, and if you have vomiting and diarrhea, it's almost certainly true that you have abdominal pain. Those people would have two of the four criteria. The third criteria is to have a positive Ebola test. But again, we don't know how the tests perform in widespread use on a population that is not infected with Ebola. We don't know how reliable this test is. And the fourth criteria is in the 21 days before onset of symptoms, having either been in an infected area or having had contact with a probable or confirmed Ebola case. So basically, if you're a healthcare professional who is working in the Congo or Zaire or one of the other places where Ebola has been found in the past, and you come down with a fever and a headache, all that stands between you and a confirmed Ebola diagnosis is the test. And if the test is positive in 5, 10, 20, 30% of people normally who do not have Ebola, it's quite likely that you will be diagnosed as infected with Ebola. The tests are probably only done after the first two symptoms have been found. Healthcare workers nowadays, any who are near anybody with an infectious disease like Ebola, are tested for their temperature every day. And certainly if you phone up in the morning and say, I can't come to work today because I've got a fever and a headache, then you have three out of the four criteria. So they will rush over in their hazmat suits and they will give you an Ebola test. And if you test positive, then you are an Ebola victim. They do not do the Ebola test on people outside the group that they feel are at risk for Ebola. The Centers for Disease Control states, diagnosing Ebola in a person who has been infected for only a few days is difficult because the early symptoms such as fever are nonspecific to Ebola infection and are seen often in patients with more commonly occurring diseases such as malaria and typhoid fevers. So this is just confirmation of what we already know, is that the symptoms with which they are diagnosing Ebola, the symptoms are very vague. They're symptoms that are caused by many different things, and it's important to realize they're not just caused by infections. Fevers and headaches can also be caused by exposure to toxins or even severe stress. There are many things that can cause these symptoms. Probably working in a hazmat suit in a tropical climate is one of the things that can cause you to have fever and a headache. In Liberia, the Centers for Disease Control used the following definition, which is a little bit different from the European definition. They used fever as the first criteria, and then they insisted upon three or more additional symptoms, but they're all extremely vague. Intense fatigue, myalgia, which is muscle pain, headache, nausea, difficulty breathing or swallowing, hiccups, abdominal pain, vomiting, and diarrhea. A probable case included also contact with a person who had a case of Ebola within the last 3 weeks, and then a confirmed case was with laboratory evidence. So it's very similar to the European definition, but you need more of the secondary symptoms in order to be diagnosed as a possible case of Ebola. Let's look at some of the cases that did occur. There was a famous case in the United States where a healthcare worker got on an airplane and had reported that she had an elevated temperature of 99.5 Fahrenheit before she took a jet. There was a big public panic. But according to a paper by Makowiak, 1992, which was the only recent study of human body temperatures that I could find, the normal range of human body temperatures is up to 99.9 degrees Fahrenheit. So this woman, although she was warmer than average, did not have a temperature outside the normal range of body temperature in healthy people. So she probably was perfectly normal, and this was just a panic. It caused a big hoo-ha just because people thought 99.5 sounds like a really high temperature compared to 98.6, because most people in North America believe the human body temperature is 98.6 plus or minus 0.1 degrees, which is not true. Human body temperature has a reasonable range of temperatures of at least 1 degree on each side of the 98.6. Similarly, Médecins Sans Frontières sent a staff member home from Liberia because they were diagnosed with Ebola hemorrhagic fever. But the only symptom that was mentioned in the article in the press release from Médecins Sans Frontières was a fever. So again, what did this woman have? Well, she had a fever. That's criterion number one. She was working with Ebola patients, so that's criteria number four. They did laboratory tests on her to confirm an Ebola infection, so she had a positive Ebola test. Maybe there were some other symptoms that they didn't mention, such as a severe headache, if they were using the European definition. That would have been enough to have a confirmed Ebola infection. And then, of course, since she was a valuable Médecins Sans Frontières staff member, they would have used the most potent drugs that they could find in their arsenal, and there is a possibility that they would kill her by giving her drugs that were too potent, in which case she would have been registered not as a death from adverse reactions to experimental drugs, but as an Ebola death. If we look a little bit more detail at the test, there are a couple of papers that are more recent indicating that the tests are not really all that accurate. For example, there's a test from Russia, the cities of Minsk and Odessa, which is certainly a long way from anywhere that's ever been known to have the Ebola virus. It says 4 to 16% of examinees were seropositive to Ebola virus. And it's not exactly clear why they don't give a single percentage, but even if the percentage of people they examined was 4%, if you test millions of people, you're just going to get an overwhelming number of false positive Ebola virus test results. Now, that is an antibody test. The tests in use for Ebola right now seem to be genetic tests, PCR tests. But PCR is well known to have false positive reactions. It's an extremely sensitive test. And I've seen no discussion of widespread validation of PCR tests for Ebola on the general population. Again, in 2010, there was a publication that looked at the country of Gabon, where there was an epidemic in the mid-1990s. But what they found at that time, where there were no epidemics ongoing, was an extremely high rate of positive antibody tests, and in forested areas of Gabon, they found a 19.4% positive rate. In the grasslands, 12.4%, in the savanna, 10.5%, and near lakes, 2.7%. There were no other factors that they measured that were associated with positivity on an Ebola test. So why is this? Why are the antibody tests testing positive in places where there's no active epidemic? These writers were not quite as creative or quite as thoughtful as the writers from Gabon in the mid-1990s. They said what this shows is that Ebola is not really a very serious illness, and that many people have been exposed to Ebola and had either no symptoms or symptoms so minor that they really never thought that they were sick. And they believe that these people were exposed to fruits contaminated by bat saliva. Now, there is a little bit of a problem with this, because if a disease, if a virus in some people causes nothing, and in other people causes devastating illness, you know, hemorrhagic fever is a devastating illness with blood coming out of your mouth and your anus at the same time, out of your eyes, it's a horrifying illness, which is, I think, why Ebola has precipitated so much fear. But if that's the case, then there needs to be a cofactor. There needs to be something along with Ebola that causes the hemorrhagic fever of Ebola, that causes the horrifying conditions that, according to this paper, only a very, very small minority of people infected with the Ebola virus would have. But if we don't know what the cofactor is, we don't know whether or not the cofactor by itself can cause those things, which is basically to say that we don't know whether the Ebola virus, as detected by antibody tests, if we can accept the Ebola antibody tests, we don't know whether the Ebola virus is important at all. What the authors did not imagine was that the Ebola test is just not very good, that the Ebola test tests positive in people who do not have the virus. In fact, we don't really know that anybody who tests positive on an antibody or PCR test actually has the virus. In order to verify that, you would need to purify the virus. You would need to inject it into a susceptible animal. You would need to obtain the same symptoms, such as the hemorrhagic fever symptoms, and then you would need to repurify the virus. That's known as Koch postulates, and as far as I am aware, there's not a single virus that has ever satisfied Koch's postulates, and virologists have spent the last 100 years trying to evade the need to satisfy Koch's postulates. Let's talk about the transmissibility of this virus. We're told that Ebola virus is not airborne, and therefore we shouldn't worry about it. But on the other hand, healthcare workers wear suits that are supposed to be airtight. And in Texas, there was a nurse who wore protective gear who tested positive, and so everybody is assuming that somebody did something wrong. Somebody didn't properly seal their suit, or somebody opened up their suit while they weren't in a sterile area, or something like that. But how could it be possible that she would be contaminated with Ebola if she was wearing this protective gear, and nobody knew of any protocol violation? Is it possible that she tested positive because the tests are just not reliable? Another issue related to transmissibility, every time there is a new infectious disease, one of the first things the Centers for Disease Control does is to ban breastfeeding, and this is no different. On September the 19th, the CDC produced recommendations that said, when safe alternatives to breastfeeding in infant care exist, mothers with probable or confirmed Ebola virus disease should not have close contact with their infants, including breastfeeding. Now, in a true case of hemorrhagic fever, people are basically close to death. So it's hard to see that a woman who is bleeding from her eyes, her mouth, and her anus would be in any condition to breastfeed an infant. So it really would not be an issue in those cases. But I think you're seeing by now that the Ebola fever of 2014, and even of earlier, is not a hemorrhagic fever anymore. It is a mild fever with a headache or some other relatively generic symptom and a positive Ebola test, an Ebola test that we cannot really rely on. The reason it looks like an infectious disease is because of the fourth criterion, which is contact with somebody with Ebola or being present in an area in which Ebola is prevalent. So it is only an illusion that Ebola is an infectious disease. If we tested people outside the zone of Ebola who had fevers and headaches, we would probably find many of them tested positive. And if we tested people who did not have fevers or headaches, we'd probably find that many of them tested positive. So by only testing people who are in contact with people with Ebola, we create the illusion, and it's only an illusion, that Ebola is an infectious epidemic. And this, we have this irrational fear occurring amongst people. For example, in Africa, it's been found that tourism has been affected because people don't know much about the geography of Africa, and so if they were going to go to, say, Kenya and sit on a beach, they won't go because they fear that Ebola is there, even though the current epidemic is on the other side of the continent. It's interesting to hear from Laurie Garrett, who is a famous infectious disease journalist who's made a career out of drumming up fear of this infectious disease, whether it's AIDS or the 1918 flu or anything like that. She is never short of drumming up fear. And what she wants, I guess, is more military people in Africa to prevent Ebola. I'm not sure what military people do. But she cites the fact that when there was a tsunami, the U.S. and Singaporean military sent 12,600 military persons and the entire, almost the entire Pacific Fleet, 48 helicopters and every naval hospital ship in the region to the tsunami area. But they haven't done this for Ebola. But really, will the U.S. military do anything except treat important people? Perhaps doctors and nurses, government officials, are they actually going to start treating the ordinary people in countries like the Congo, Guinea, Zaire, or other poor African countries where the unmet health needs are measured in the millions of people, and that there are far more important problems than Ebola? The CDC helped with the fear, the epidemic of fear, by estimating the number of future cases in the Ebola virus. They estimate that it will continue to grow exponentially for some period of time. And this helps create the fear that Ebola will come to the United States or to Europe. And in fact, that is why the world is concerned about Ebola, because they think it will affect them. If it's malaria or tuberculosis, which seem to stay in Africa, there's very little concern. If there's malnutrition and stunting and pollution and careless use of pesticides and unventilated mines, those are African health problems that stay in Africa, so really the level of concern in the West is almost zero. The Daily Mail, which I always like for social interest stories, it's a British tabloid, mentioned that from American airliners to British buses, the number of Ebola false alarms mounts as panic grows over spread of this deadly disease. There was a scare at the Liverpool coach station after a passenger collapsed and vomited. Medical staff boarded the coach in protective gear and removed the woman. Doctors at Liverpool Hospital confirmed she did not have Ebola. Another scare occurred when a man yelled, "I have Ebola," on a flight from Philadelphia. Four hazmat officers rushed onto the U.S. Airways plane, which is going to the Dominican Republic. In Australia, a plane made an emergency landing when a passenger vomited blood. A test shows the Czech man, who had symptoms of Ebola, when, as we know, those are credibly generic, did not, in fact, have the virus. A woman in Taiwan tested negative for Ebola after showing symptoms of the virus. The CDC is handling more than 800 false alarms a day from worried Americans. The Dallas County Sheriff tested negative after being in Thomas Duncan's flat. So you can see how fear has basically gone throughout the population because everybody believes that the disease is a risk to them, and nobody really knows what it is. But let's go back to 1976 and talk about what were the symptoms that were found back then. This is a paper, one of the 1977 papers from Lancet. It says, between July and September 1976, sporadic cases of fever with hemorrhagic manifestations were reported in the southern Sudan in agricultural settlements. An outbreak of a similar disease was also reported from the zone of Bumba in northern Zaire. The illness began with an acute fever, malaise, sore throat, muscular pains, vomiting, and diarrhea. So these are the generic symptoms we're still talking about. However, those severely affected had epistaxis, which is nosebleeds, bleeding in the eyes, coughing up blood, vomiting of blood, and a thing called melena, which is the vomiting and excretion of dark, bloody material from, so vomiting from the mouth and excreting from the anus. Some patients also had a body rash, tremors, and convulsions. So here we see that there was, in the 1970s, an extremely serious illness occurring in people. And this could have been explained by some environmental factors, such as uncontrolled exposure to certain pesticides. But nobody looked into that. They just looked in to see what virus was causing the disease. The panic is pushed by much of the mainstream media, whether it's on the left or the right. It either thinks that Obama is doing the right thing or it's not. It either thinks that we're not being told the whole story and that it is actually an airborne illness or not. They think that everybody should be quarantined or just some people. But the newspapers, the mainstream media, are having a field day based on the assumption that this is an infectious disease. Another example of the fear of Ebola was that there was what appears to be a fake screenshot or a screenshot of a fake website that was selling a sexy Ebola nurse outfit just before Halloween. This outfit, which was supposedly selling for an exorbitant price, had a very short plastic dress that looked vaguely like the plastic in a hazmat suit, and it had little yellow plastic leggings. Of course, since it's a sexy Ebola nurse, it had to be a short skirt, and it couldn't be the full coverage hazmat suit that might really scare people when they came to the door. But what I found most interesting about that was the horrified comments from the politically correct newspaper in England known as the Independent. They said, apart from the abhorrent idea that someone would want to sexualize a medical suit that had been used to treat the 10,000 people affected by an outbreak of a deadly disease, the picture also appears to be a fake. Probably this was a fake. Thankfully, just somebody on the internet attempting to provoke outrage, which they appear to have done. I would say that it was sarcasm about the irrational panic that's gripping everybody, but the newspaper obviously didn't realize this. Another very recent example of the panic, as reported by CBS News, is that American soldiers returning from Liberia are being placed in isolation in Vicenza, Italy, out of concern for the Ebola virus. The soldiers in isolation include Major General Darrell Williams, and they are now is currently a total of 11 soldiers. They were met at the airport by Italian police in full hazmat suits. If the policy remains in effect, everyone returning from Liberia, several hundred, will be placed in isolation for 21 days. In fact, I believe there's several thousand soldiers going to the Ebola zone. So the American military could have an incredibly expensive operation of greeting each of these people every time they return from Africa to Europe or America or anywhere else, keeping them in quarantine for 21 days. But let's look at some of the possible reasons why people would like to see this epidemic. I don't like conspiracy theories. I don't think people said that in a room and said, let's create an epidemic in Africa. But I do think that when there is declared a small outbreak of something like Ebola, there are people at companies who say, gee, we have a vaccine and we need to do clinical trials, or we have a new Ebola test, or we have an experimental drug that might be effective with Ebola, whether it's specific for it or not. And let's check this out. And when the World Health Organization declared earlier on that this was a deadly epidemic, that changed the ethical rules for clinical trials. So now a vaccine or a drug can be tested on people even though it's not proven. It's not clear what scientific benefit you get from using a drug in this way. if you treat three or four people with an expensive experimental drug and one of those people dies, does that mean that the drug is effective? What if three of the people die? Will you then say, well, we caught them too late, we should give it earlier? It's not really clear that there's any value to it. And is there any value to the patient in being given medicines that are probably quite toxic, that have significant side effects? Let's look at an example. The first man in America to die supposedly of Ebola was Thomas Eric Duncan. From a news report, it says he traveled from Liberia to Dallas and sought medical treatment on September 25th. He was released by the hospital, readmitted on September 28th, and the virus was detected on September 30th. Mr. Duncan was receiving the experimental drug brincidofovir, which had been granted emergency investigational new drug applications for use as a potential treatment in patients affected with the Ebola virus. In addition, he was on a ventilator receiving kidney dialysis, and it had been showing improvement in liver function, which is a bit of a strange statement. It doesn't describe the exact sequence of events, which side effects occurred after he started receiving the experimental drug. Now, this is a drug of concern because it is what is known as a nucleotide analog. People who know a little bit about AIDS will know that all AIDS drug cocktails contain one, usually two, nucleoside analogs. So you'd be right in assuming that a nucleotide analog is similar to a nucleoside analog. Both of them are the beads that form up the chain of DNA. In the case of a nucleoside analog, which is used in AIDS, the drug has to go through a process known as phosphorylation before it can be incorporated into the growing DNA chain. But in the case of a nucleotide analog, that's already been done by the drug manufacturer. So theoretically, the drug should be able to be absorbed into a cell, and then it will immediately be attached to a growing DNA chain. The problem with these drugs is that when a DNA chain receives one of these analogs, it basically stops growing. And so randomly, DNA, which is being duplicated every time a cell divides, DNA is stopped from dividing. This can cause the growth of cancers. It can just cause generalized cell death, which can cause things like muscle wasting. If absorbed by bacteria, it will probably kill the bacteria, which in your intestines could cause problems with digestion, the digestion of food, which is assisted by bacteria. So these are incredibly toxic drugs. And in this case, the man died. So what does this tell us about the drug? Did he have a bad case of Ebola, or was he killed by aggressive treatment? And did his need to be on a ventilator and kidney dialysis and problems with his liver, did those occur after he started the drug, or were those in existence beforehand, and what other drugs and other treatments did he receive? We probably won't know until well after the epidemic. Maybe somebody will publish more details about his treatment. Another possible reason for taking advantage of the Ebola epidemic is that GlaxoSmithKline and also the Canadian Public Health Service both have vaccines that they want to test. Now, of course, they can go into Africa and do testing of the vaccine with many fewer constraints than before. The World Health Organization has said that they want millions of doses of an Ebola vaccine by the end of 2015. GlaxoSmithKline is actually not quite so optimistic, but maybe GlaxoSmithKline is taking the smart route of being a little bit reluctant and letting the World Health Organization pull them into the vaccine program, and then, of course, any problems that occur will be more on the World Health Organization's shoulders than on theirs. Now, who's going to be paying for an Ebola vaccine in Africa? In poor places, it's not likely to be the people living in Africa. So we in the West will be expected to open up our pockets to pay for the Ebola vaccine programs. So things like Bill Gates Foundation will presumably be asked to provide millions of dollars to pay for this program, and governments will be asked to pay. And, you know, if we were saving lives in Africa, I would be happy to pay some money for that to happen. But we really don't know. How would we know that a vaccine really worked? We would have to give the vaccine to a large group of people and a placebo to another large group of people. It has to be double-blinded, so neither the people injecting the compound nor the patients knew whether or not they'd received the vaccine or the placebo. And then we'd have to expose them to the Ebola virus, because, of course, once this epidemic is over, then there presumably will be no Ebola around. So you can give people a vaccine and they don't come down with Ebola, but that means nothing, because you give people a placebo and they don't either. So you'd actually have to expose people to Ebola and see whether the people who were vaccinated got less, were infected less than the people who got placebo. I think you can see some ethical problems with this. If Ebola really is a deadly infection, then it would be completely unethical to expose people to Ebola just to see whether they get sick or not. So there's really no way to properly validate the vaccine. So probably what will happen is GlaxoSmithKline will see whether people develop antibodies to Ebola. But this is going to be a little bit of a problem, because already it seems like up to 30% of people in different areas already have antibodies to the Ebola vaccine. So are they going to take people who have no antibodies to Ebola, give them the vaccine, and then see whether they get antibodies, and then assume that those people are going to be immune to the Ebola virus? That's probably what's going to be done. But it's going to be big business for the World Health Organization and GlaxoSmithKline and the Canadian government as well. Now, another possible reason for so much interest being in Liberia is due to an American military organization called AFRICOM, the Africa Command. This is based in Stuttgart because there's currently no African country that wants to host AFRICOM. But if the United States, through the Ebola epidemic in a country like Liberia, which appears to be at the center of this, if they can persuade that country they'd be better off with a big U.S. military presence, so anytime there's a future epidemic, there'll be soldiers to deal with the epidemic, even though I'm not exactly sure whether the world needs soldiers to deal with medical problems, as opposed to possibly things like basic health care, a more equitable society so that people have better jobs, have better living conditions, aren't living in slums. Do we really need soldiers to save us from infectious diseases? But one can see that the U.S. military would hope that the Ebola epidemic would end up with enough soldiers on the ground in Liberia that the government would just say, okay, set up a base in Liberia, bring in a few thousand soldiers, set up your AFRICOM headquarters, and then the American military will be very happy because now if they want to do anything in Africa, they can fly in the special forces from Liberia to any country that has Muslim terrorists or whatever the next enemy of the United States will be. That appears to be a big goal of the U.S. military, which, again, I don't believe that the U.S. military said, let's create an epidemic so we can take advantage of this. But when they perceived that there was an epidemic, they said, now we have an opportunity. That is what I believe probably happened. And I'm sure that the people in the U.S. military have no questions about whether it's a real epidemic or not. They probably sincerely believe that it is. Maybe they also sincerely believe that soldiers can help with epidemics. But I am skeptical, and I think a lot of people are skeptical, but the end result could be that we have no choice by the end of this. What are some of the possible alternative causes for Ebola? I was going to say hemorrhagic fever, but we need to remember that the current Ebola epidemic is not an epidemic of hemorrhagic fever. We do not have people coming in with hemorrhagic fever being diagnosed. What we have is people coming in with fever or cough and a positive Ebola test who are being diagnosed. There probably are some cases of hemorrhagic fever, but certainly among healthcare workers, that's not really what's happening. So it's not really clear whether we have a real epidemic of anything at all. But there are cases of hemorrhagic fever that occur sporadically through Africa. Now, something that occurs sporadically is probably not a good candidate for an infectious disease. Environmental conditions are much more likely to cause sporadic problems. If everybody in North America has toxic pesticides in their shed, which they use on their grass, there's going to be a kid who decides they want to eat them. There's going to be somebody who prepares the pesticides in a barrel or a bucket and puts their hands in the pesticides, not realizing that they can be absorbed through the skin. It's not that everybody on the block is going to all come down at the same time with pesticide poisoning. It's going to be extremely sporadic. And it's known that pesticide usage in the third world is extremely there's basically no standards, that poor, uneducated farmhands who are working on big plantations will be told to use pesticides, given no information about the toxicity, given no protective gear. So in a 2014 paper that was published just before, well, actually just after the Ebola epidemic apparently started, it said pesticide poisoning data have not been collected in the Sahara region until very recently, but some large-scale incidents have been reported, and there are frequent reports of ill health and hospitalization. Respiratory problems are associated with the length of exposure to pesticides in Niger, and skin exposure is considered to be responsible for 50% of health risk in vegetables and 25% in irrigated rice. A poison center has recently been established at the University Hospital in Dakar, Senegal, to collect poisoning data. So we know from that that environmental poisoning through pesticides is a big issue. It's a big issue around the world, just not in Africa. It's being given very little attention. It's nice to know that now it's getting a little bit more attention. But if we continue to allow these cases of illness to be treated, to be examined solely by people interested in infectious diseases, we will continue to test for an increasingly long list of viruses, and every time a test comes up positive, it will be concluded to be the cause of the disease. But a positive test is not proof of causation. For example, if Ebola was, as some of the evidence I've brought today indicates, depending on how you interpret it, if it is a virus that's actually not very pathogenic, then finding Ebola in somebody means very little, because it appears that the vast majority of people who are positive on Ebola tests had no symptoms, or at least not major symptoms of the disease. Worse yet, if the tests actually are not accurately testing for the presence of a virus, then the question of whether or not the virus is causative is moot. But we need to look in. We need to do a full examination of people that come in with unusually devastating symptoms, such as hemorrhagic fever, and look at all of their potential environmental exposures, work exposures, home exposures. There are many, many ways that people could be exposed to chemicals. Pharmaceutical drugs. There are severe allergic reactions to pharmaceutical drugs that could cause internal bleeding and the breakdown of the body. Another possible cause would be a vaccination. Adverse reactions to vaccines can be also very devastating, and it's not that there were millions of people coming down with this illness. They were isolated cases. Again, information on any vaccination within the last month or two would be very important, because if a pattern emerges that the majority of these people with this hemorrhagic fever had all received the same vaccination or a similar vaccination within the last month, then obviously we'd have to start looking at a vaccine. Pharmaceutical drugs are used very carelessly in Africa. There's very few constraints on pharmaceutical drugs, and that's another thing that should be looked at. What antibiotics or other drugs did the people who got sick take? Maybe they had a minor illness, they took drugs which caused an adverse reaction, which caused the devastating symptoms that they came to the hospital for. There are many things that could be looked at, but as I've mentioned, if we continue to allow epidemics to be examined by people who can only think about infectious causes, then we will continue to get infectious explanations for the illnesses. I hope that this show has given you food for thought on the issue of Ebola, and I hope you will continue to listen to future episodes of The Infectious Myth.